about a bunch of things. There are people at home, and there are people in apartments and houses and cars, and people listening in the street as well. Well, I guess that's not so unusual in a world where more than a quarter of the population could be called homeless. So let's dedicate some of the program to the homeless and the banned and the fired and all the people who lost touch with their own communities because of the way the world has been moving. Let me ask some of my guests to identify themselves. This right over my shoulder, let me just say that Troy Reed is here, and he is making a documentary about Larry Davis, Adam Abdul Hakim, who we'll talk about a bit later. And I haven't checked my mail. Maybe we've heard from him again. John McDonough is here as well. John?
Here in solidarity and to sit at the feet of the master. I've always wanted to do this, and it's a great privilege just sitting here watching you operate.
At the feet of the master, is that some kind of religious affiliation you're referring to, John? It's at the feet of the master.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'll be observing you today, this morning.
I'm in trouble now. Are you doing this in some official capacity? I remember one time I made a tape, videotape, and I got introduced to some, somebody who I thought was, the real president of Ireland as a result of that tape. Less or more on that later. Peter Jameson is here this morning with his fantastic, incredible guitar and some wonderful songs, right next to Peter Jameson is Mr. Amato, no relation to the opera. And Mr. Amato, I love the mandolin with all my heart, and I love to hear it played, and only because of my nervousness and my anxiety, your first name has escaped the slithering of my decaying brain cells. But if you'll tell us that, I'll be in your debt.
Okay, it's John.
John Amato.
Right.
Oh, thank you. And right to John's left are two of the companions, the constant companions, I would say, of John McDonough, who are your names are?
My name's Cassie.
Jillian.
Jillian is visiting this country for how many?
2 weeks.
How long have you been here? I mean, other times before, or?
I've been here once before.
Oh. Have we changed very much?
No.
We're pretty much the same. You have contempt for us, I suppose. Well, what would you tell us to do? How could we straighten it out? That's our problem right now. We don't know how to straighten it out.
You don't need to straighten out. You're fine the way you are.
Well, no, I'm not talking about the people in this room. I mean the rest of the crazy world. No? Well, you're going to hear some stories and some things said about how crooked the world is and can be, so be prepared for that. Thank you for coming up here, and anytime you want to say something, just say it.
Okay.
Okay. How about you, Kathy? I know you've been on the radio many, many times.
Yep.
She used to co-anchor with Grandpa Al Lewis.
Out of fact. I hope he's listening this morning, and maybe we'll get a call from him. Sorry?
Hopefully.
Uh-huh. Now, if you have earphones in front of you and you put them on, you'll automatically get to the right distance from the microphone. It'll happen. You'll see. And you're all welcome. Who is this with you, Troy?
Larry Davis' niece.
Named?
Kat is her name. It's Larry Davis' niece. She's assisting me here.
Well, you, same for you. You come up closer because you're going to probably want to say something too. That's Bill Propp over there in the doorway. Good morning, Cabal. Welcome to Radio. But first, this important announcement. No, this important announcement.
Hey, this is Andrea Clark, sister from another planet. The only time you can catch me in orbit now is every Friday morning, 10 to 12, and I'll still be playing the best progressive and conscious music on the planet. So tune in every Friday morning from 10 to 12 on WBAI 99.5 FM. Revolutionary Love.
I would hope that if you wanted to call Andrea Clark and ask that Panama Limited be played, dedicated maybe to Robert Knight, she'd probably do it, right? Don't you think?
Than the sun, yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic. Hark, now hear the sailors cry, smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. Just like way back in the days of old, and magnificently we will fold into the mystic
Then Jesus came like a stranger in the night. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. I saw the light, I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. Just like a blind man, I wandered along. Worries and fears I claimed for my own. Then like the blind man, God gave back his sight. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. I saw the light, I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light.
And this is a dedication to all those people at the Good Light bulletin board. And there are a number of bulletin boards that have been detailing some of the wondrous happenings with comments of one kind or another on what's been going on here at WBAI. Have you seen any of them, John?
Every Saturday I go back to see the reviews of the show. And, you know, they can be quite critical, but there's people from around the world that can listen on the Internet and then put up their critiques for better or for worse. And I think it's uncensored. And this is the listeners' views. If they can't get on to the radio and the airwaves here through the phone lines, they're certainly doing it through the Internet, and they're using the new technology, I think, to a great advantage in keeping everybody up to date on what's going on. If you go away for half a day, you can come back and they'll tell you, you know, such and such a phone call said this, and it's really monitoring what's going on here.
Well, tonight for a little bit, I want to tell the listening world, whatever it is, and I know that it may not be large in number, but it is large in influence. The people who traditionally listen to WBAI are in what I like to call the electronic information community. They always have been before computers were so important a part of that community. There were people who worked in newsrooms and people who worked in other networks where they weren't allowed to tell these stories. And, you know, they would often call and say, keep it up, right on, that's what we would like to be able to do. Here's a story that you might not have known. You know, I mean, there was a kind of a feeling of camaraderie that I know still exists in other radio stations around the world that are tuning in on this, too. You must have some stories to tell about people who picked up on what you were doing through the Internet.
I mean, we have a website called iraradio.com, and we actually have more listeners on the site than we do here at the station, because it's people from Australia. Like, they do printouts of how many hits, and they get like between 20 or 25,000 hits a day. And that would be from around the world listening when we put it up on the Internet. It's just wonderful having access to all this new technology. And it's being given to us by people that support the show. It's being handled out in Kansas. We actually have someone on the east side of Manhattan tapes the show on Saturday, then through the cable system sends it out to a way station out in Kansas that runs the website. And then from there, people from around the world click on and, you know, hear what we did that Saturday on WBAI. It's just, it's unbelievable, the technology.
Well, it's a new world. Those, what do they call it? The electric world. Yeah. The electron world. Now it's the digital world.
Yeah.
It's all ones and zeros. We don't really exist. We can all become ones and zeros, you know. They think we're zero, but some of us...
we got the ones downstairs. It's great to walk through about 20 or 30 people downstairs greeting you as you're coming in.
Yeah, right, carrying signs and listening and having an animated conversation and, you know, saying like things like to each other. I heard overheard conversation. You do? I do too. Oh, why don't we go and have some coffee someplace? You know, and they walk off down the street holding hands. And, you know, it's great. You know,
there's very few radio stations that would get that kind of response from their listeners that they would be out at 12 o'clock at night down in front of the station. I mean, it's just, it's amazing.
Well, I think there are very few stations that would have, you know, more than a little bit of gastro, you know, reflux disease if any one of their broadcasters was switched or changed. But here, this is an audience of people who have bought and paid for something that, you know, it became central to their lives. People listen to the radio. I mean, it's amazing how important the radio is to people. Peter, did you ever see that poem by Brecht where he talks about, as an exile, how his little radio followed him and gave him bad news from, you know that? Peter Jameson.
It's immensely important. The radio, you know, for a lot of people, is their neighborhood, is their life in some ways. There are people that are infirm. There are people that are caught up in job situations where the radio helps them a lot. And this radio station in particular has been a community bulletin board for many years. It would be a shame to see it change more than it has. And the change that's gone on here is, to me, understandable. And I think a lot more could be gained here with dialogue than the behavings of summarily firing people, essentially. And it just makes me very sad as a longtime BAI supporter.
Well, you were, for a long time, central to the War Resisters League. You were at the head of the War Resisters League at a certain point.
Well, I wasn't the physical head, but I was at the headquarters of the War Resisters League doing military counseling. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, you were the chief counselor for GIs and who got into trouble because they didn't want to go to
the Gulf War, fight for an oil company with a flag.
That's right. So they would, you know, you would help them to prepare their defense and find the grounds for it, give them a place to...
And we can't forget the...
Stay. I was about to say hide.
Yeah, well, there were
that
many...
That was what happened to you. You had you were a draft resister who discovered it too late.
Well, after two tours of Vietnam, I was a slow learner, but I did, yeah. Mm. I did, yeah.
Do you think if you would have listened to BAI before you were drafted? I joined in 1973 with guys from the neighborhood.
I did.
I just think, Bob, if I had the brains to listen to BAI at that stage instead of some of the knucklehead music I was listening to and maybe listen to stuff that you were putting out.
Well, I don't really think it was the media. I mean, the schools were to blame in a way, because I went through 4 years of Catholic high school in New York, and John did as well, and I don't think there was ever a class saying that the war was wrong.
No.
Can you recall anything saying the war was wrong?
And it was almost patriotic duty to join. The draft was just ending, and we said, oh, well, that's not going to stop us.
I was a third-generation combat veteran.
Peter, despite what you just said, isn't it true that nuns and priests were always at demonstrations?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
They sometimes would bring their classes with them.
Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
You know, having trouble moving the conscience of their parishioners, but they were, at a certain point, they were trying to get it going.
Not for lack of trying. I mean, there were always great figures like Dorothy Day and Daniel Berrigan and Philip Berrigan and others who, fortunately for me, ended up being my military counselor when I had my trouble with the military. But it was troubling times, you know, it was troubling times. But it went on to the Gulf War, where we had many Marines, as you remember. We were involved with court-martials of Marines at Paris Island and Camp Lejeune, Marines that refused to go to the Gulf and were sometimes incarcerated and sometimes mistreated, you know, but... They were very brave souls for religious beliefs, because Muslims are not allowed to fight other Muslims. And then there were people that just got it, that this thing was about oil, you know, so.
Peter, you're making some kind of...
Yeah, the red microphone guitar input is way, way, way hot. If you can just bring it way down. There you go. That's better. Anywhere that's coming. I'm sorry. I just was... If you push it up a little, yeah, anywhere. Anywhere that's good for you, it's good for me.
Oh, well, that's great.
I'm sorry for interrupting. I just didn't want
to... No. You took us in the direction we should be going.
Okay.
Would you like to play some music?
For the poem?
Well,
we'll play something to warm up. And
I'm not quite ready. I have to find the first.
Let's play a song that I'd love to play for BAI and for Bob Fass in particular. This is a. Once upon a time, you dressed so fine. Threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say, beware, doll, you're bound for. They thought that they were wrong, kidding you. You used to laugh about. Everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't feel so proud about having to be scrambled for your next meal.
after he took from you everything he could steal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be on your own? No direction home. Like a complete unknown. Like a rolling stone. On the steeple, and all the pretty people, they're drinking and thinking that they got it made. Changing all kinds of precious gifts, and you better lift your diamond ring, and you better pawn it today. Napoleon in rags and the language that he used. Go to him now, he calls you, you can't refuse. When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. You're invisible now, you got no secret to conceal.
Back Bay drain pipe. Hold, please. The Monongahela backwash. Hold, please. Certainly took you long enough in there, didn't it?
My God, 5 minutes. And Jesus Christ, Max, you can't just put everyone on hold and leave them there.
Hello? Let me see if I got this. I get to Atlantic Avenue and I make a right.
Yep, and the worst right there, and you can't miss it.
Right, got it. Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
There was a movie maybe some of you saw called Between the Lines that had to do with the takeover of an underground newspaper by, I guess what you could call the 1977 version of corporate interests.
Well,
it was, it was the beginning of a certain kind of engulf and devour that was taking on place in this country at the time. Do you remember anything about that movie, John? Did you ever see it?
No, no.
Well, maybe we should be talking about a different movie.
What the hell's the matter with you? Don't you
about
stop when a man takes
you people trying to sell newspapers in the street in some kind of an underground progressive radio station. But it meant something for a lot of us at BAI in 1977 because we saw that this was being reflected, that other media outposts were at least aware that something was restricting and constricting in this country. Now, I don't see very much awareness that anything is happening in the rest of the media, do you? Except for that wonderful piece in the Daily News this week. Did you see that?
Yeah, and it's just limited strictly to a radio piece, and it doesn't take in the bigger picture of Disney owning this and General Electric owning that. I mean, it's just confined to some quirky FM station and a lot of people being fired and laid off or suspended in animation for indefinite periods of time. And I think as it gets more corporatized, all the media, it's going to get harder and harder to get anything into the media. And just these are one of the few airways that we can get out alternate points of view about what's going on in the world. Whether you agree with it or not, you should listen to it and then listen to the other media and then come to your own conclusions after that.
And as I've said before, there are a lot of ways to support this kind of broadcasting. You can send money to the station, or you can send money to the people who want the station to be a better station. You know? So it's a unique and wonderful place. I have a story that I want to tell about it, if I can. Well, actually, it doesn't begin at the radio station. It begins when a patrol car stops at a street corner in a neighborhood that I guess you could call kind of controlled and restricted, and sees a guy who looks like he may be selling drugs. And they call him over to the patrol car, and he thinks he's going to be arrested. But that's not what happened. He was asked to come to the station, told what a smart kid he must be, and how they needed someone like him to help them with their work. Now, this is a 14, 15-year-old kid. Larry was 15, I think, at the time. Larry Davis was his name. And he went for it when they said, look, you're going to make a little money. You're going to give a lot more of it over to us because we need it for our work. But you're going to get everything you need, man. You're going to be selling things for us here that people want anyway. You know, guns and drugs, and we got them. And you'll be selling them to the people in your neighborhood, the people who know you and trust you and who admire you just the way we do. And, hey, there were very few people in this young man's life who told him that he was admirable. And despite the fact that he was strong and he was smart and he was trying to find a way to take care of his sisters, brothers, and his mother, too, a few other people in the family were all soon living a better life because this young man was selling drugs and guns for the cops. 15, 16, 17, 18, he has a religious conversion and becomes Adam Abdul Hakim. And he says, wait a minute, this is wrong. I should be teaching my people how to get along in this terrible world rather than giving them guns and drugs. And so he goes to the police station and he says, I don't want to do this anymore. Here your guns, here your drugs. Keep out of my life. And so a night or two later, they came to kill him. There were children sleeping in the apartment, and he did have a gun that he hadn't turned in under the bed, and when they invaded his home, he protected his hearth, just like some of the people in the stories I've heard on your program, John, when the black and tan came in, they behaved as though it was the man. And, of course, it was. And they defended themselves. And the inevitable happened. They were overwhelmed, even though there were a few more casualties in this horrible drug war before the event was over. There was a trial. William Kunstler was his first attorney, and a jury found him innocent. He did get found guilty on the charge of possessing a gun, even though it had been given to him by the authorities. He was found guilty on that and sentenced to a year that you must serve. If, at least that's what Mr. Mayor Koch told us, if you have a gun in the city. So he was sent to jail, and somehow after a very short time being led to some place to get x-rays or down some back corridor, he had an accident on the stairs, allegedly, and he was confined to a wheelchair. Of course, he tells it as though something quite different happened, that he was, overwhelmed by the guards, and they decided to teach him a lesson, and they beat him into the wheelchair. Now, the guards deny this, but unfortunately, one of their own television cameras, their surveillance camera, showed them doing it. So this man, Larry Davis, confined to a wheelchair in prison, called Lombe Brath and Bernard White somehow, and they passed the information on to me, and I took a call or two from him at home, and I recorded one of them. And I brought it in, played it on the air, and then he arranged for a live call. And in the studio with me were Judith Molina of the Living Theater, Xavier Wardlow Muhammad, and a group of other people who were in a play that we were doing together at the Living Theater. And I remember Xavier when Larry Davis, Adam Abdul-Hakim, told the story of what happened to him. Xavier said, "Be careful, brother. They want to kill you." And the beads of sweat, I remember, were on Xavier's brow when he said that. Xavier's back in Philadelphia now. He's a playwright. He's done a lot of plays at the Theater for the New City. And he wrote a play, as did a couple of other people, about Larry Davis. And that's why Troy Reed is here tonight, making a documentary film to tell that story. So I just wanted to mention that. And I've gotten a few letters from Larry Davis, read them from time to time. I went to the play. There was an actor who played me in the play, but I wasn't actually in it. And I met Larry's mother, right? Were you there with her that night? Do you remember? But I met Larry's mother.
No, I wasn't there that night.
Well, Larry's mother had a strange event, too. Somehow she slipped and broke her ankle. And, of course, she went to the hospital. And she went in with a broken ankle and came out dead. Now, how does that happen without some kind of divine or other intervention? I'd like to know. Have you ever seen anything like that happen?
Well, I don't know. Sidney Zion could probably tell you a story what happened to his daughter, too. She went in healthy and then came out dead.
Mm.
And I know he sued the hospital and they actually got some laws passed about what happened to his daughter. So a lot of things happen, and particularly city hospitals. If you ever ended up in any of them, in an emergency ward there, it is just a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And just depending on the degree of the injury you have, they put you on some sort of waiting list where you could be there 6-8 hours just sitting there bleeding or with broken bones, waiting to be seen by an intern who probably hasn't slept in 48 hours, who then misdiagnoses you and... As I said, the rest could be history. If you can't afford a nice private hospital or have coverage to go to these hospitals, if you have to go to Elmhurst in Queens, I mean, that is a nightmare hospital, and that's where all the prisoners from Rikers Island go. That's the hospital that they're taken to.
Well, you know, you can tell about how twisted things are without my paranoia, but I just want to tell you that my feeling is that somebody wanted to get Larry Davis, and that's why his mother had such a bad time in the hospital. And I have something that somebody sent me. It's like a little, I don't know, I guess it's a poem. Sent it to me in a newsletter. And I would like to read it, and I wonder if you people would, like, play a little background with it. Peter and John, if that's possible. It's called They Murdered an Anarchist. He lay on his back in the street, eyes closed, arms at his side, legs akimbo, blue jeans but shirtless. He looked almost peaceful, except for the massive pool of blood that trickled out of two bullet holes in his head. This young anarchist, Carlo Giuliani, 23 years old. He would never again protest, dance, sing, attend meetings, or embrace friends, brush his teeth, or cook breakfast, or love another anymore. Murdered in cold blood by police on a sunny afternoon in Genoa, Italy. Moments later, Carlo encircled the globe, entering homes thousands of kilometers away via the internet. Photographed from a dozen different angles, once passionate, alive, and angry, seconds later, silenced. Still. Felled by two gunshots, then run over by a police jeep escaping the murder scene. Millions of us never knew you, Carlo, anarchist brother. But now your name is stenciled on the tongues of the speechless. Your lifeless body now fixed in the minds of the incredulous, immortalized on the front pages of newspapers. You alone with then a circle of dozens of blue-helmeted riot cops staring vacantly and puzzled over your corpse. Oh, you died like a butchered animal, a dog in the street, so that a gang of wealthy, powerful criminals could shake hands and smile and slap each other's backs and drink fine Italian wine safely, knowing that they had a 20,000-strong bodyguard prepared to tear gas and to beat and even to murder protesters like you, like us. To allow them to continue to conduct their sordid business uninterrupted. We know they're not troubled by the death of one anarchist or a handful of anarchists. They oversee the daily violence of the state of capitalism, obliterating whole families, communities, towns, regions, tribes. The needless, preventable deaths of millions worldwide. One less troublemaker won't stop them. Oh, Piccolo, you tried. Made you pay with your life. Your blood, Carlo, was hosed away into sewers where it mingled with the blood of the homeless, with the blood of those forced to beg and starve every day, with the blood of broken bone, poisoned, beaten workers, men, women, and children, with the blood of others who died at the hands of the police. All these soldiers and hired assassins. Your blood infused them all with a fierce rage. The rage of the forgotten, the voiceless, expendable. Victims of a money-crazed world gone mad. And this blood-red rage rose from the sewers and poured out of the mouths of screeching rats and spilled into the streets of Genoa. Into palaces and boardrooms and reception halls and limousines and stained them all red, a carpet of blood. It overflowed into rivers and oceans. It touched continents far away. It crept onto beaches at night, staining them red, and it oozed its way onto signed agreements and memos and documents that seal our fate, but which we never see. And it stained them red, too. To remind everyone of the rage of those like Carlo who die so others may profit. To remind them that this blood-red rage has just begun. Seems to have been written by someone named Norman Naraki. And I thought a little bit about documents and things that are given to people to sign and orders of banning. You know, I heard a program someplace recently on BAI, maybe. I'm not sure who was doing it. Maybe it was Alambe. About the bannings and the history of the licenses in South Africa. What was that? You had to carry papers that identified which particular racial grouping you belong to. Remember that? What do they call those? Passes. Passes, right.
Well, to even go to certain parts of South Africa, so you needed certain passes to go.
And, of course, you could be banned.
Oh, even Nelson Mandela's wife was banned to her house within the country itself.
And fired upon.
Yeah. And it's just ironic. The Bush administration, just 2 months ago, banned two legal Irish groups from coming into this country and ban them from speaking here, and BAI has provided the only alternative for them to get into the country is through these airwaves. And it's ironic that Robert Knight, who did a lot of the interviews of the people that are banned, his voice is now not heard here at WBAI. So it's strange happenings.
Did you ever see the Panama Deception?
Yeah, yeah.
He won the Polk Award for that with Valerie Venisla.
No, I listen, even down in Panama when that he was on the run and went running to the Vatican, he knew to call up the WBAI, Manuel Noriega.
I thought you meant Robert Knight.
Well, Robert, too, because he was probably on the run when he was down in Panama.
Can I ask you if you would say anything about Larry, maybe? Do you have something that you might like to...
I just want to say that in doing this documentary, and hearing the different stories from the different ones that we interviewed, it just made me reflect upon how really Larry has suffered over the years, you know, being abused, being abused and beaten, and it's just annoying because I wasn't raised to believe that the system was like that, and to see just different footages and listening to different ones, it just made my heart very heavy to know that for 15 years this man has been tortured and still fighting for his life, and it's just very heavy on my heart. And I just want to do whatever I can to make sure he do leave this prison and be able to live his life the way he was meant to live it.
Him and I would say another couple of million other people. There's a town in Texas that Robert Knight just did a report on called Tulia, where the sheriff of the town has admitted that he trumped up charges against 40% of the black population, that he arrested people, sent them to jail, just because, you know, he wanted to please his bosses. Didn't matter that they didn't actually have the drugs that he said he found on them, but, you know, he figured that if they had the chance, they probably would. Or whatever it was that was in his mind. Maybe it was just that he was loyal to whoever's name was on his paycheck. But the drug war has many horrible, horrible victims. And as horrible as the story of Adam Abdul Hakim, Larry Davis, is, he is just the tip of the iceberg of the people who are in jail for nonviolent crimes. That you could say that he had done something that was violent, but the number of people who are in jail for nonviolent offenses, and the number of law people who have been killed or injured in the enforcement of the drug law, the number of lives that have been, you know, just turned to, you know, to, I don't know, to nothing by the drug war. Just amazing. And it's time to stop it. If there wasn't so much profit in it for the people like the Bushes in places like Colombia, there wouldn't be a need for the drug war. I know for a time they were saying that the IRA was in the business of guns and drugs. Is that...
Send money, guns, and lawyers. No, Bob, my sister's on the job here in the city. She's a cop, and most of my relations are. And there's a thing called Operation Condor that's going on now, particularly up in Washington Heights.
So is Peter's family in a lot of ways.
But the pressure that's on the cops to make collars every night, and it doesn't matter if the collar sticks or not, they have to come in with numbers. And because of the low wages a lot of the cops are making, this federal money that's coming in for Operation Condor is a way for them to get overtime. And there isn't even a thought in their head about the people they're arresting. All, and I know from going to barbecues and stuff, when they talk about it, all they talk about is, we have to have numbers. When we come back to the precinct, what did you do that night? They don't care what the type of arrest are. It could be a joint, a crack pipe. It doesn't matter, as long as they make arrests. And then each arrest is overtime. Now, these guys are looking at big mortgages out in Long Island, and they don't see the social effect that's having on these neighborhoods. All they see is, I have a mortgage, I got to pay it, and if I got to arrest five people a night in Washington Heights or the South Bronx, that's the price that's going to be paid. And that's the you could say, the collateral damage that's going on with this drug wars and all the prisoners of war in this drug war. But it affects everyone. From the bottom to the top. And they're putting people like the cops into positions where they have to go out and they have to make arrests. And if you don't make the arrest, they bounce you out of the unit you're in because you're not being productive and you're not using the federal money that's coming in for this Operation Condor.
Peter, do you want to give us another song, or do you want to...
I have a song, actually, that... unintentionally segues perfectly. It's a song called Spodey, and it was written by David Lindley quite a while ago. God bless you, David, and it's on his first record, but it's about this whole thing. So you see if it is.
They said he had a bottle and a 45.